Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every week two nerds get together to rate, read and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm his co-host, who just likes to smile evilly, Duncan Nicol.
Duncan, this week I said we're going to get back to basics, and I think I definitely succeeded in that task. This time we read Homeland, the first book chronologically in the Legend of Dritz series by R.A. Salvatore. There's going to be a lot of discussion in this episode about pronunciation, so for one thing, I'm pretty sure I just mispronounced the character's name again. It's not, as I keep saying, Dritz. It's Drizzt. And I realized the moment I started reading the book, like, wait, I've been saying this wrong the whole time. And the author's name is not Salvatore, it's Salvatore.
Well, we're off to a cracking start with this pronunciation. I'll tell you now, it's not going to get any better.
I think, Duncan, I've been nice to you, or rather, I've been less mean to you about pronunciations over the last year or so. I think this one episode, I might have to be a little bit... I think it's going to be funny to hear you try and say some of the absolutely ridiculous names which Salvatore comes up with.
That is, if I remember them, because I'm not going to lie, quite a few times in this book, my brain just had to default to who so said... Dritz's brother. Like, my brain just couldn't even compute. I was just like, nope. Moving on.
That makes sense. Plus, a lot of the time, I was thinking, like, this is one of Dritz's sisters. I'm not sure which one, but it's one of them.
Right, so before we dive in to Homeland, Geordie, have you been reading, watching, enjoying any other fantasy or non-fantasy you want to share with us?
Duncan, I'd like you to go first, please.
Okay, then. Well, yes, I have been enjoying other works. Geordie, I've been on a kick reading the Valerian and Loreline comics. Familiar?
Right, that's the City of a Thousand Planets, right?
Well, that's the movie, Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. The actual comic, I believe, is called The Empire of a Thousand Worlds, or Thousand Planets. Makes a lot more sense. But yes, it's a French comic book that ran between, oh gosh, I think like the late 1960s all the way through to like 2011. And then it had like a reboot version of it. Very interesting to read.
Okay.
Very.
So you were.
Yeah.
After reading the movements, you were like, I want to read more foreign cartoons that are extremely influential and lasted for an extremely long time. That was what you were in the mood for.
Guess that's a way to put it. To be honest, the actual mood I was in is the fact that Doctor Who was finished and I needed my fix of time travel / space travel adventures. And that's very much what Valerian and Loreline is. It's firstly a massively influential comic. You can just jump onto YouTube and you'll find video after video sort of drawing the parallels between Valerian and Star Wars, similar to how we were doing the parallels with like John Carter and Star Wars and Superman. Hugely influential. Probably more impactful for its influence than maybe people today that actually know it. That said, really, really good. Like, really shockingly well written. Obviously, I'm reading an English translation, so there's some talk there about what influence that has on the text, but very, very strong read. I've been reading it in the omnibus format because that's just proved so much easier. So it's a comic book series, but Geordie, it's kind of, I think it was originally in like newspapers. And so it then got collected into, I mean, today we call trade paperbacks. Then it was called albums. So each story arc is then presented as one album.
And how much of it have you read?
I'm just about approaching halfway. So the standard run is like 21 albums long. And I'm just getting to...
Sure.
I think I'm on number 11 at the moment.
And
I highly recommend...
And you're having a good time.
I'm having an amazing time. I think what I really enjoy, because it's we're in the far future of humanity. And basically, the premise is humanity's got to the point where most of the human population, we've built a massive empire, we've solved all our problems, and now we've basically built our own matrix. And most people spend their days hooked up to this, but there's a contingency of humanity whose job it is to make sure, while most of people are having a good old nap, things don't fall apart. And these are these, like, Galaxity, so what the organism is called. They have these space agents, and one of them is Valerian, and the very first story is a time travel story. And he goes back to medieval France, and he meets Loreline, who then becomes his, like, long-term partner. And it's a very kind of Doctor Who kind of vibe, in the sense that each album, is it going to be sci-fi? Are we on the Empire of a Thousand Planets? Or are we the heroes of the Equinox? Or these really cool high-concept ones. It's got some really nice, like, I'm not going to lie, left-leaning political messaging, which I'm digging, about the environment and equality and, you know, those annoying little things which are so important and explore some beautifully. But it also has a really nice dynamic of, like, Valerian being the spaceman, the agent. He knows what he's on. He's a very cocky kind of guy. And Loreline just kind of being that little bit more down-to-earth, keeping him in check. Great written banter between the two characters as they kind of go from story to story to story. I genuinely think, actually, I'm starting to praise it more than I originally thought I was going to. But as I started talking, I thought, actually, no, I really love it. And I think it is just fantasy enough. Because in the very first story, someone is basically casting magic. So I think that clears it. Although it is predominantly...
Well, in that case, I was about to say that I might check this out, but maybe I'll wait until you force me to. But I'm definitely intrigued by that, and I'd be very happy to give it a read.
Again, you will not be disappointed. But Geordie, that's me. Over to you.
So yours was a little bit of a departure from Dritz. It doesn't sound like there were many elves or Dungeons & Dragons involvement in that whatsoever. No. I stuck a little closer to Drizzt. I was in the right mood for it. I said, okay, what else can I find which is in the same vein? And so I haven't asked you yet whether you liked the book. I'm sort of gonna have to give the game away here when I say that I really liked this book, and I liked it so much that I am now halfway through book 3 in the series.
Oh, my life. Wow.
Yeah, it just kind of grabbed me. I don't think this is an exceptional book. I don't think it really stands up. You know, when we do our next time it's top 100, I don't think it's going to be in the upper echelons. But it did give me a bug. And I have, that bug has given me a major fever. I plowed through... I enjoyed book 1, and then I plowed through book 2. And now I'm in book 3, and I think it's just getting better.
Okay, wow, okay. Fair enough. I guess I need to give my thoughts on Homeland. So, this is the first book chronologically, fourth ever written. The Icewind Dale trilogy,
that's right,
which is the second trilogy written first, bit of a Star Wars case there. Funny enough, because Salvatore... wrote some Star Wars books. Not the first time I'm going to make that comparison. And this is the first of a series of, like, 30?
It's 39. He's written over 100 books. Not all of them are Dungeons & Dragons, but I think most of them are. And 39 of them, as Duncan has said, are about this one character, Dritz Do'Urden.
Like, that is a character arc. At least I hope it is. Like, that's so much content.
I hope it is too.
That's crazy. That is, like, bear in mind, just throw it out there. One of my most popular series in the world, Discworld. It's only like 41 books. What, like, Discworld length? Just on Drizzt. No, Drizzt. You have programmed me to forever get this wrong.
Duncan, I'm very sorry. I take it. I take my lumps. We're going to get a lot of names wrong in this. In fact, I think we should probably pretty soon just go through Dritz's family and see if we can figure out what these people are actually called.
Right, true. But before that, I need to give you my statement then. So, yes, I'm amazed by this. This is my first introduction to the character, by the way, although I have Icewind Dale sat on my bookshelf. I have not gripped around to it yet. Maybe some more regrets, I don't know. And I haven't really experienced Forgotten Realms. D&D. I've been playing D&D for, what, 8 years? We've been playing D&D together? Give or take.
We started playing together in 2016, so 9.
9 years. In all those 9 years, do you know how many games I've played in the Forgotten Realms setting?
None with me.
None. I played, like, Dungeon of the Mad Mage, I think, which I think is Forgotten Realms.
Yes. That's right.
But it's very, you know, it's a very isolated genre setting. It's one big dungeon. So, and I didn't even get off floor one without dying. So, not the most experienced. So this is a lot of introduction me to Forgotten Realms, to the lore of D&D games. To be fair, the movie was set in the Forgotten Realms, so I have...
It was, that's true. And it starts in Icewind Dale.
It does, actually. Oh, makes so much sense. But still, this was a big introduction to a world. All that said, Geordie, so, in a way, yeah, I finished the trilogy too.
Really?
In a way. So, I read this book, and I really enjoyed it. I did. I enjoyed it. It's not perfect, to be brutally honest. Going back to the Star Wars comparison, very similar to some of the stories there. It gave me very strong vibes of when we were talking about the Thrawn trilogy by Timothy Zahn, in the sense that
absolutely.
It was a good book, but it very much felt like part one of a single story that kind of had just so happened to be cut up into 3 volumes. This book ended in such a way where I'm like, well, I need to keep going. That's not really an ending, is it, guys? Come on. I say kinda, though, because, Geordie, I didn't read the book of the next two. I actually, turns out...
Do you read a comic book adaptation?
Yeah, I read the comic book adaptations.
Fair enough.
Is that shameful?
I don't know. I feel like these would translate pretty well to comic books, because the, But, you know, because they are very action-focused, and it's all about, like, people going on journeys and stuff. I feel like that would translate well. The only issue I would have with that is that, one, obviously you're allowing someone else's direction of what the characters look like to sort of influence you, and that's obviously fine. I'm a big fan of a lot of comic books. However, a lot of the art associated with Dungeons & Dragons is just bad.
It certainly wasn't the most beautiful comics I've ever read, but they're not the worst. Also want to put that out there.
Yeah, I tried to read the first Dragonlance comic book, and I could not get over how absolutely hideous the characters were. Especially the dwarf characters, just like, he's just wrong. He gave me genuine, uncanny valley experience. And I'm not a guy who experiences the uncanny valley, but I was like, this is wrong, it's disgusting, and you should not be allowed to release this.
Well, that is harsh. I mean, I haven't seen this comic, so maybe I shouldn't speak yet. In fact, no, let me have a quick look up. So this is Dragonlance comic. Let me see if I can see what...
Dragons of the Autumn something.
Oh. Ah. Okay, I'm looking at quite an old style comic, quite a limited color palette. Yeah, I can see where this isn't the finest. The adaptation of Homeland that I read, I think it's the only adaptation to be fair, was a bit more modern than that. So for people not knowing the images we're looking at, we're talking like, so the early comic books where it's very like single block colors, where they had like a very limited color palette, basically to keep printing costs down. Whereas as we go into more modern digital colouring and higher print, you do get a lot more fidelity there, particularly when it comes to like shading. So the Homeland comic, which I read, I believe was released...
I'm looking at it now. I'm going to assume late 90s, just by the art style.
I think it was early 2000s, but I could
be mistaken.
That makes
sense too. I'm reading it now. It looks hideous. I don't like it at all, but...
I don't think it's that bad. Oh, no, it's 05. Wow. Okay.
The point is, it got its hooks into both of us. We were both like, this is obviously a promising start. Because to be honest, I think Homeland is... I haven't finished a third book yet. Homeland is definitely the least of them. It is very much an origin story. It's all about let's get Drizzt to where he needs to be at the start of Icewind Dale, so we know how did this guy get from the Underdark, the underground realm of the Dark Elves and all the other horrible things that live under the earth, how did he go from there to being an adventurer up on the surface? And why is he the only good Dark Elf? Yeah, let's actually talk about what is this book about, who is Drizzt, all that stuff.
That sounds an excellent start. So, Drizzt is the third son born of Matron Malice. What a beautiful name.
And that's the last time Duncan's going to say a name in this book with confidence.
And he's born into a drow family, and we're very quickly brought into the politics of the drow. So the book actually starts on the day of his birth, and we see the sort of political backstabbing that the drow execute. This is a society that runs on being a bit mean. It's just being evil. Like, they genuinely just go around praising each other for being, like, wicked or conniving or backstabbing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of subtlety. Their god is the spider god Loth. I think I got that one right.
Loth.
And these are the characters that they aspire to. And what we see at the very start is this idea of that it's technically illegal in this society to just, like, murder people and go to war with another, like, noble house. Unless you do it really efficiently and so quickly and are utterly brilliant at slaughtering all of them, in which case it's kind of like, oh, well done, actually, that's really impressive. Okay, yeah, no, we'll let you off for that. That was badass. Well done, guys.
There's a sort of tight... A weird tightrope which the book has to walk between, like, we need to Drizzt to grow up to be a true and noble warrior who's extremely heroic and self-sacrificing. How does this come out from a society of, not even a society, according to the official Dungeons and Dragons books of the age, because this is written during the age of second edition, you know, drow, dark elves, are universally evil. There aren't any good ones. You know, they're all bad. Some dungeon master of the time would say, you're not allowed to play a drow elf because all of them are evil and I don't want evil people in my party. Salvatore, his big innovation was, all right, I'm just going to do one. Just one good one. That's going to stand out from the crowd. My hero is not a human. He's not an elf. He's not a half elf. I would say he's not a dwarf, but there aren't really that many D&D books that I'm aware of where dwarves get to be the actual principal heroes. They're always the sidekick. But stands up in the crowd. This guy is supposed to be evil, but he's not. Oh, why is that? Let's find out in the fourth book in the series. She's going to go back in time. We're going to become book zero.
Am I here to give the answer to that question? Because it may seem like this whole book is about giving you that answer. And it's a bit... This is almost like the strength and the weakness of the book, in my opinion. So I'm going to come at this pretty head on. Drizzt, in many respects, is just sort of fully formed.
Yes.
And this is in two key regards. Number one, he's just not as evil as everyone else. Everyone else likes to smile. I'm not going to lie, a description used one too many times in the book. Like, They can just be happy. They could just be smiling at something evil. And I feel like that would almost be more unsettling. But side point. And he finds this a bit bothersome. He's just a bit more pro-mercy. He just doesn't want to kill kids. And the others just do. And it's not explored, I think, overly well. Because he's had a very similar upbringing. There is this inclination, and we'll get into more detail, of a mentor character. Who I'm going to call Zach.
His full name is Zach Nathan.
Somewhat is meant to...
Yes, you can call him Zach. The narrative often calls him Zach.
Who does maybe impart a little bit of, like, being a good person. But I personally didn't buy it was enough to, like, influence this child away from the rest of society. And the second point about Drizzt that is very fully formed is he's just really badass. He's just the best swordsman. He can just do the magic. There's even a great scene, which I really appreciated, where one of our, I don't know, main villain, side villain of the book, I don't know, another drow, is literally going around and he's like, saying how he's so annoyed about him, not because he's necessarily the best, but because he doesn't seem to care, and he's so effortlessly the best. So I'm like, yeah. Yeah, it is a bit of a thing, isn't it? And clearly that's the character. Like, I'm sure R.S. Howard Hawks, like, he knows what he's doing and he's choosing to write it this way. But it almost comes like, I've shown up to see the origin of a character, to be honest, I didn't know beforehand. And all I'm getting is, yeah, he is just good and he is just that great a fighter.
So the tricky part is that when I picked this book, people had said, when you read Drizzt, start with Homeland. And I didn't do that. I started with the Icewind Dale trilogy because I like to read things in publication order. I often think that's the best way to do it. And also, I was planning on running the Dungeons & Dragons adventure, Icewind Dale, Rime of the Frostmaiden. I wanted to see where Icewind Dale came from. And it was really helpful. I'm very glad I did the background reading to run that campaign. I've run it twice, and every time I incorporate stuff from the original books, which don't make it into the official adventure, because I feel like it really fleshes out the world. And that's part of the reason why I enjoy reading the very few Dungeons & Dragons books I have. Because even though they're not great literature, I like playing Dungeons & Dragons, and I really like the sense of authenticity and canonicity that the books provide. So when I introduced you to it, Duncan, I was like, I really hope that this is a good introduction and it does a good job of explaining how did Drizzt come to be what he is. Because when he shows up at the start of Icewind Dale, he's very straightforwardly heroic. He's already an extraordinarily good swordsman. He's very, very rarely challenged in an actual physical way. So I was interested to see what it would be like to go back before, especially since this is where people say you should start. And frankly, I don't think this is the right way to start. My recommendation to listeners is that this is a good book, this is a good book series, but you should start with Icewind Dale. You should start with The Crystal Shard.
Well, thank you for ruining it for me, Geordie. I will hold this against you forever.
You can't say that. You've literally, you're now further into the series than I am.
No, that is very true. And I still, and I want to be clear, I still got enjoyment out of this book. I just felt like I went in with a certain expectation that wasn't delivered. And I hadn't even read Icewind Dale, so I wasn't even that curious to learn about Drizzt. I just knew this was the book that told me the origin of Drizzt. So I went, okay, let's see the origin. And the origin is, he came out of the womb, and then smash cut, well, two time skips later, he's a noble badass soldier. And I'm like, okay, well, we better get on with being a noble badass soldier then, mightn't we?
And
it was this weird...
And I will say, the end of the second book is... Sorry, the end of the first book is... He leaves. Like, he's had enough of his life in his home city of... Duncan, take us away. What's it called? That's right, Menzo Berezon. And he leaves and he says, I quit, I'm done, I'm going to live by myself. Without turning this into a review of the first two books, it's really fascinating to me that that's the cliffhanger it ends on is, okay, what's going to happen next? Is he going to go to the surface? And it jumps 10 years later. And a lot of the actual conflict you're expecting to see in this book, Drizzt, warring between good and evil, actually only shows up in the second book. It gets, you could very generously say it gets set up in this book, but really the conflict only actually ignites in the next one.
The kind of curious factor here, you talk about this conflict in good and evil, and obviously, yeah, that came across when I was reading the sequel comic. By the way, the main reason I did that is because I did actually already own these, and I sort of wanted to read more, and I just sort of went, oh, I just want to see how the comics adapt it. And then that just led me into the second one. Just to put that out there. Anyway, I want this conflict, how it's going to be set up, and I'm okay with him, like, just being a better person. Because I kind of feel like that must be... No, sorry, I was about to say, that must be a thing. Maybe it's a thing. That on its own is okay for someone to come to the one, but like, I'm just more empathetic than all of you guys.
Well, I want to say this.
Fine.
I want to say this. Recently, in the history of Dungeons & Dragons, and I mean this in terms of the publication of the games. So last year, 2024, The Wizards of the Coast released a new version of the game, not called 5.5, not called edition number 6, called 5th edition 2024. Even though the subsequent two books of the three books that make up the core set of rules came out in 2025, so it's extraordinarily badly named, they made a decision. Something that they had been progressing towards for several publications, which was they just took out all the evil races. You can no longer choose to play a drow elf, and the game specifically says, okay, drow have these specific skill proficiencies, which represent how warriors are trained in drow culture. You no longer just like start off knowing their language of Undercommon. You no longer have like the drawbacks of being a drow elf. Now, you play an elf and you may choose to incorporate aspects of being a drow elf. And the book also explicitly says, drow are not all evil. Menzo Berezon is. This specific city which Drizzt came from, they're definitely evil. After all, this book is still canon to Dungeons & Dragons. It's just that you shouldn't make it like this is a actually representative model of what it's like to be a drow in the world, or what people will think of drow in the world.
Well, that's good for them. That's a lovely retcon to put in. That is not in this book. This is all drow. They are all evil. I do actually really support the idea of... And I don't know... what the opinion... I'm not really tuned into the D&D, like, zeitgeist and general vibes from the community, as one way to put it. I just think do away with, like, alignment, personally. Just don't mechanicite, like, it just...
Yeah.
Whatever, anyone can be evil. Just throw in the bin. What does it really add
that's a very,
to the
that's
game?
That's a very popular and common... that's a very popular and... present theme. A lot of people just don't really care about that stuff anymore. Don't really bother to write down what a character's nature is. No one I know playing would say, if you are playing a drow elf, they must be evil. That being said, there is something a little bit toothless about saying, we have depicted drow elves being a certain way for this lengthy period of time, and now we're going to do away with it. And the reason for that is because drow elves are dark elves, not because they live in a darkness. And we should point out, before we go any further, the reason why there are dark elves in Dungeons & Dragons is that there are dark elves in Middle-earth. But dark elves in Middle-earth don't live underground, so they are not dark because they are under the sun, and they aren't, crucially, dark because they have dark skin. Which the drow do. They're dark because they never saw the light of the trees. We are not going to explain what that means. You either know it or you don't, but it's not important. The point is, they basically look, or should look, physically, like any other elf. They just didn't have a certain enlightening, magical experience 20,000 years before the start of The Hobbit. That's why there are dark elves. The very literal interpretation...
Do we meet any dark elves in Lord of the Rings?
In Lord of the Rings? No, they're all gone. They're all gone by then.
Okay.
I'm not completely up to scratch on my D&D lore. I think Legolas is, or is partly, a grey elf. Which are people who were told about Valinor. And, like, went to the coast, but didn't cross the sea and, like, live in Valinor. I think that is true. I'm not sure. I might edit that out. First, I'll check if that's true, see if I'm vindicated, and if I am, it's in the episode. So everyone knows now why I sound so clever on the podcast, because I take all of the times that I'm wrong. What was I saying?
It is true.
Okay, so some patch notes. First things first, and most importantly, I am vindicated. Yes, the Moriquendi, the Dark Elves, as they describe them, are indeed the elves who heard about the light of the trees, but did not go to see them. Where the important distinction comes down is that there are two types of Dark Elves. There are those who refused to call completely, and, like I said, those who came halfway. Now, here's the tricky part. I can't seem to find a consensus on
Are the grey elves who didn't make the full journey, are they dark elves? Because if to look, to behold the light of the trees and be changed by them makes you a high elf, a light elf, then that means that almost every single elf in Lord of the Rings is a dark elf, not a high elf. So Elrond is a dark elf because he never saw the light of the trees, even though his lineage is made up of high elves. So is a high elf something that you inherit, or is it something that you just get? It's just, did you see the trees? Most elves, even in Valinor, would therefore not be high elves. They'd be dark elves, which is weird. So it's complicated, but most importantly, yes, I'm very clever.
What was I saying? Right. Gary Gygax invented Dungeons & Dragons in the 1970s. And something you need to know about Gary Gygax. Not a great bloke. Very misogynistic. And pretty racist. But in a sort of casual way. In a sort of, I've read a lot of fantasy novels and I don't need to examine my preconceived notions. Why is it that the race of evil elves have dark skin? Something else you'll have noticed about the drow, which is not merely that they have gotten less evil over the years, their skin has lightened over the years as well. When you start off, they have black skin. If you look at the original cover for this book, Drizzt has black skin. And I don't even mean like African black skin. Black. Like jet black. Which is like uncomfortably close to a revolting racist cartoon. So over the years, they've changed color. They will start off as black, then they start to go a bit more gray. Duncan, in the comic book I'm looking at right now online, it looks like they've become purple, which is where they stay for a long time. The most recent novel depiction of Drizzt in a video game, he was blue, and I mean like ice blue.
Interesting.
Now, I will say this, and this is what I was coming up to first of all, right? Obviously, showing the drow as having jet black skin, not good, bad, it's racist, especially when they're depicted as the evil race. There's a reason why you can't watch the best episode of Community, if you know, you know. However, I will just point out that as the drow have gotten gooder, they've also gotten paler. So, the great irony of, we don't want to have the idea that the drow are inherently evil, there's just a couple of bad apples, has also gone in line with, now let's make sure we don't have as many dark characters, like physically dark characters, in our stories.
It's sort of like, if they changed one aspect, it would have been like quite a positive thing. But by doing both things simultaneously, they've sort of done a bad, it's like two rights have made a wrong. Let's not have our inherently evil race be of a darker complexion. But then they've gone, let's not have a singly evil race. But then by doing them both simultaneously, they've like basically saying we can't depict.
They've whitewashed just the characters, yeah. Overall, like they're all getting paler, they're all getting lighter at the same trajectory that they're getting gooder. Anyway,
yikes. Not a factor to the book, but thank you for bringing it up, and it's something I think, you know, you do need to address, because this is part of the culture being presented. And I think, I don't know, it's an issue with any time you kind of want to write an inherently, you know, evil society. Particularly in this story as well, this evil society is so cartoonishly over the top, mustache twirling, smiling evilly society. It feels completely other. Also, I did also get a bit of an ick. You talked about, you know, we're talking about the kind of the race issue being associated with evil. Also, an extremely matriarchal society is depicted as irredeemably evil.
Yeah.
Again,
yeah.
Another slight ick.
That one's complicated as well, because on one hand, that is absolutely, like, again, Gary Gygax, an extraordinarily misogynistic man. He wanted the all-female player characters to have a negative attribute to strength, because he felt like, oh, that's realistic. Whatever, dude. You made a game about fucking elves. So he's created this purely matriarchal society, which just so happens to be inexplicably evil. evil. I will say this. I just have a really fun time with the evil femme fatale dominatrix drow elves running society. I just think it's weird and fun.
Well, we've all learned something new about you today, Geordie. Thank you for that.
Listen, I don't want a big spider lady to step on me and hit me with a whip. I'm saying that is not something I want to happen. But I do like the weird change in dynamic. I also think that, you know, this is just like what I was saying about the lightening of the drow skin lining up with them becoming less evil. The topic of gender as it relates to drow has vanished completely. Like, there are no explicit gender dynamics written into the lore of the game in the latest edition that relate to the drow females being on top, which is obviously relates to, like, black widow spiders, female spiders eating the male spider.
Which is fascinating because it's such a big part of this book.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Like, as much as it's, like, nice to do away with, like, the negative aspects, like, the dark races are evil, now, why would you want to play a drow, you know? Like, what about it is fun and interesting to be like, I'm a renegade against an evil system? There was a period of time when people wanted to play Drizzt so badly. They wanted to be dual-wielding rangers with a panther companion. They were a dark elf so much that this became a meme. Like, a meme within the Dungeons & Dragons fandom in, like, the 3rd edition era, which is before my time, so I'm not talking about from personal experience. But survivors of the time can relate that was banned. That was banned. It was not allowed in the game. But if you read the 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons when it came out, there are rules specifically put into that game so that you can play Drizzt. You can be a dark elf. Dark elves explicitly get proficiency with scimitars. One of the animal companions you can get is a panther, and the panther's stats have been specifically designed to make sure you can get it as an animal companion, even though panthers should be way more powerful than they are in the game, just to make sure that you can be Drizzt. There's a real appeal to it. And I feel like a lot of that appeal has been taken away because now there's no flavor whatsoever. They don't have a matriarchal society because they don't have a society. The one society we have an example of is now the exception.
I think one way you maybe approach this is the fact that there's a lot of complexity when you're representing these societies, particularly when you want to throw around these, like, universal evil rules about them. I think where things kind of get problematic is the fact that if we're only ever having one matriarchal society in all of Forgotten Realms, then all of a sudden you can read a lot into it. It's like if we were talking about, I don't know, a human kingdom. If one had a king and it was really successful and one had a queen and it was not very successful, you could read into that. But if there are 8 human kingdoms with a mixture of kings and queens and it no longer correlated, then it falls down and then you're just showing a rich and complex world. Because we've only got one, it's almost like they've taken out when what they really need to do to solve the problem with add in. Show us another drow city that was just a bit different. Like, add, don't subtract, to then kind of work your way around this.
Right, and the other side of that coin is, what if we had a surface elf society that is matriarchal and we decided that we're going to show it off as a paradise? You know, we're going to say that this is a perfect society. We've got her land and, you know, like, we're going to show this off and it's perfect and something needs, nothing about it needs to change. Everyone there is happy, even the men who are subjugated under the system. Well, we're not actually having an intelligent discussion about gender at that point. We're fantasizing. Granted, this is a fantasy book, but you're making a statement that relates to the world, which people do believe, is that if women ran the show, everything would be better. And that's cruel and reductive to women, because the systems that are in place which make life hard cannot be as simply solved as saying if the other people were in charge, everything would be great. That's a way wider discussion than we're prepared to have in a discussion of The Legend of Drizzt, a book in which a man goes to assassin school and doesn't learn anything about being an assassin, and keeps being surprised when his classmates trick him and betray him. He's like, that's literally all you learn how to do at this school, Drizzt. Pay attention.
You're right, and I think we should just bring it back to what actually is within the Book of Homeland, because what it does inside these much more kind of larger conversations, as all kind of good fiction sort of should, I think it's good that at least we're having this conversation. It's a thing of interest. It's not actually what clearly Iris Alvator wants you to be thinking about and focusing on as you go through this adventure. You want to go on the adventure of Drizzt and what he's getting up to. So let's go back to the plot. It opened on an event on his day of his birth. We get a few players lined up. We have this sort of betrayal incident where this one guy's family gets wiped out, but through some hijinks and murder, he ends up becoming the faceless one? It's like, yes, high-ranking wizard. He masquerades.
The one surviving member of a house manages to escape by disguising himself as someone else, who he then kills, and then he wants revenge against House Dewarden, Drizzt's family, to bring them down.
Because they were the ones that wiped out his house. We also get in this our first introduction to how everyone's super evil, because Drizzt is meant to be sacrificed as the third son born to House Dewarden. Go with that one. But his...
First of all, Duncan, they are called Dewarden, but that's not their full name. Do you remember what their actual family name is?
Not in the slightest.
Okay, so I understand that, because their full name is Daemon Neshezberanon.
I understand why it was shortened.
Yeah, I understand too. So what happens from this point is, Drizzt is supposed to be sacrificed. He's the third son. That means that he gets given up to the Spider Queen, Lolth, the god of the drow. He already has an older brother. The eldest is a wizard. The younger is the warrior. Drizzt is despair. But before he can be killed, right before, the second son of the house, Deenan, he murders his brother Nalfane so that he can become the first son, and Drizzt is spared because of this. And he gets raised up by his sister to be the replacement, to be the next wizard of the house. However, Drizzt's life gets changed because I'll just say it out loud. His father, because he is his father, they try and make it a mystery in the book, but it's not. His father is Zaknafane. He's the chief weapon master of the house. He's the Gurney Halleck. There's a lot of Dune in this book, and part of that is having a Gurney Halleck in the mixture. And he's his father, he's the occasional lover of the matron of the house, Malice, and Zaknathan is not a bad guy either. He's kind of bad, because he really likes murder, but he only likes murdering the priestesses of Lolth, who are all bad, so it's fine that he's murdering bad people.
Solid logic. I'd be honest, it's the get out of jail free card. You know, I'm not a bad person, I've only been killing bad people. That's what every villain in any fantasy probably thinks to themselves, apart from these drow, who clearly know they're being evil. It's fine, ultimate justification. But yes, he's the better one, and he's certainly set up to be the positive influence that's meant to, like, guide Drizzt. At least that's how I interpreted it. Their time together is fleeting. And to be honest, he speaks a big game about, like, being maybe a bit more honourable. But I don't think he ever puts across anything like, yeah, maybe give mercy a try or kill less children.
That's the interesting thing, is that Zack Nathan managed to wrangle his way into becoming Drizzt's master. He spares him from going off to the magical school, which is called Sorcerer, which is just a bit much, to be honest. He manages to wrangle it so that he's going to be his mentor, and the way in which he teaches Drizzt to be a great warrior is he says, okay, this is my apartment in the great house Duoden. You're not going to leave this place for 10 years. And Drizzt is like, that's a really long time. Are you actually crazy? He says, no. It's really important that you only talk to me, the one good guy in the city, and not your crazy family. So obviously, what Salvatore is putting out here is that the reason why Drizzt is able to become a good person is the influence of Zack Nathan. Now, the question is, at the heart of the story, is Drizzt good because Zack Nathan raises him to be good in this 10-year span that he looks after him from the age of 16 to 26 before he goes off to assassin school? Or is he good because Zack Nathan is fundamentally good and that goodness was passed on to him by hereditary?
Both answers are problematic. I'm not a big fan of the fact that we do skip over most of this, like, almost entirety of this 10-year period as well. So we don't really get to see how he influenced him or the lessons he teaches him. There aren't that many examples of him sort of, like, picking Drizzt up and being like, no, you know, we do it a better way.
Exactly, because the interesting thing about it is that he never tells Drizzt, I'm teaching you something different from what all the other drow are learning. He does teach Drizzt to be merciful, because like when they fight, he doesn't like say, and now after you bring him down, you kill your opponent. When Drizzt fights people, he knocks them down, he puts their sword to their throat and says, do you yield? And that's like, not, that's weird, that's strange for a drow, because that's literally how he was trained. The friction, the narrative friction emerges when Malice comes in to watch them train, and Zack Nathan is like, okay, if Malice realizes that I raised her son wrong and I taught him mercy, she'll just kill him. So now I have to fight him like crazy. And instead of explaining to Drizzt before this, you need to behave a certain way to get away in society, he just has to, like, psychologically manipulate Drizzt into fighting as though he's a maniac drow by trying to kill him in a sparring match. Which makes for great drama, but makes for some very strange behavior later when Drizzt just doesn't understand the world he lives in.
He never gets a kind of wider explanation. I do like when he first goes away to the academy, the assassin school, that he is continuously baffled by why everyone else just tries to be evil. He does wisen up and he does like learn not to trust people, but he never quite like, I feel like, puts it together in text and goes, this is how they have been raised differently, or I appreciate my mentor Zack for like trying to instill these good values. Maybe I'm being a bit harsh. Maybe I'm asking it to spell out what it was doing a bit more in the subtext. And as we're having this conversation, I am beginning to think, actually, there is an argument to that.
But I don't think this book has a lot of subtext.
Okay.
I'm just going to be quite frank. I think it's very explicitly written. And the next book is like a little bit more subtextual. But it's also the book in which Drizzt gets a second savage alter ego, where he has a second different crueler personality, so that book's not that subtle either. Now, what I'm gonna say there is, like, where the discrepancy occurs is the conflict between Drizzt has been taught to be merciful by his father, who he doesn't know is his father, by the way. I should say that explicitly. He's been taught to be merciful. And then he has to go off to assassin school. And Zack Nathane's big conflict, because he is a perspective character in this book. The book has an omniscient perspective. Zack Nathan believes that the moment Drizzt goes to assassin school, they're going to take all the goodness out of him. They're going to work it out of him. And Driss is basically dead to him as soon as he's gone. Because he's like, I tried so hard to raise him right, and now it all gets taken away from me in the messy, messy divorce of my boy has to go to assassin school. And the conflict is, and when I say conflict, I don't mean narrative conflict. I mean, like, the contradiction. I almost used the word plot hole, but I wouldn't go that far. Drizzt is taught propaganda. This is very explicitly in the book laid out. It's like the 7 minutes of hate from 1984. He gets told again and again and again this stream of lies about Drow history, about how the Drow were betrayed by the surface elves and driven beneath the surface, and we hate them and they're all awful and our enemies, and we have to destroy them and we should show them no mercy. And the weird thing is that Drizzt believes all this. He is taught it, and he's taught it in a compelling way. He internalizes all this stuff. He believes that the surface elves are the enemy. But then later, after he graduates, his patrol goes up to the surface to murder these people. And he finds out that they're just like, they are literally not enemy combatants. They're just slaughtering innocent civvies. And it makes total sense for what we know about Drizzt that he is against this and that he doesn't participate in a massacre. And the great dramatic stake of the book is that he spares a child. But it really makes him look like an idiot. Just like a total idiot, that he can walk right up to the start of this massacre and not register the cognitive dissonance of these people are your racial enemies and you hate all of them and I don't want to kill these people. He doesn't have any conflict leading up to the scene when they're out under patrol. It's only about 1 second that conflict actually emerges.
It does read a little bit like it just so happens that he bears down on a big doe-eyed child, and that's what gets the kick in. And that if there just so happened to be a singular guard in this like group of people who like took a sword to Drizzt, he never would have had that snap moment, and he would have just gone back going, yep, job well done.
We dread to think. We wouldn't want Drizzt to be on the side of the bad guys. So, I feel like we've laid out a lot of our issues with the book, because there's the problematic themes that just are too wrapped up in the problematic early origins of Dungeons and Dragons, with the sense of inherent evilness. It should be pointed out that Zach Nathan had 2 kids with malice, and the other one is fully indoctrinated by the Drow, by the Church of Loth, and she's evil, but she's definitely the least evil of the Children of Malice aside from Drizzt. So once again, you're saying like, okay, Nurture has won out. She's been programmed to be evil. But it's also saying the her very nature inherited from Zach Nathan is an influence.
Just to be clear, she's the least evil in the sense that she requires another person to mildly egg her on before she takes a whip to a small child.
That's right. And she feels a bit sad before she helps sacrifice her father.
Gosh, do you know what? I didn't even fully clock. Yeah. It's not a lot, but it's nice to show that comparison and then why Zach feels so motivated to, like, protect this one child. But just begins into the next question of, gosh, I really wish I need a prequel that really explains how Zach became slightly less evil than everyone else in his society.
That book may well exist. I know for a fact that one of the latest Drizzt books is not about Drizzt, but it's about Zach Nathan, who I guess is back from the dead again.
Again?
Well, obviously the next book, he gets brought back as a Zombo.
Well, okay, yeah, I know, I'll cover that. To be fair, it's whenever you deal with any D&D, and I always wonder this for the books, because obviously on a game mechanic sense, resurrection is just a thing that players...
It's so easy.
So easy, it becomes almost irrelevant. I mean, we weren't playing in Forgotten Realms. Late stage, one of Geordie's game, we were dying like every other session, and he literally was just like, guys, I've written you in a god character. You basically need to keep respawning because we've got to finish the plot. You are not dying to this random mob.
There was legitimately a fight where they were they had split up all over the globe because the bad guy had attacked in multiple locations, and one of the players got up there with like a dragon god to fight their bad guys in the sky, like 1,000 feet in the air. He got knocked down to like to 0 hit points and was unconscious, and the dragon god legitimately, I realized controlling him, was like, what I'm gonna do is, he just breathed, he did his big breath attack on his own friend and killed him outright, and then the next round just brought him back to life. It was legitimately quicker to just kill him, bring him back and throw him back into the fight than swoop down, catch him and heal him.
Good luck to all the writers of D&D books for tackling that one. There is actually something I found really funny when I was doing a bit more background research about like Forgotten Realms literature. I love the fact that like I was like, okay, so what's like the best stuff to read? And the one that came up other than Drizzt was like the, I think it's called like the Cleric Quartet, and that's also written by R.A. Salvatore. I'm like, guys, are you basically just telling me that this guy's a good author and he just so happened to sign a very long license deal?
I have no idea how good Ed Greenwood, the actual creator of Forgotten Realms, actually is. I've never read any of his stuff. No one has ever recommended his book to me. He obviously is very influential because all these other writers have taken advantage of his world, but I genuinely have no idea if he's any good.
Well,
so one thing I'll say, talking about death and healing in Dungeons and Dragons, is that in the Icewind Dale trilogy, there is a core party of adventurers. In this book, Drizzt basically fights alone, which is obviously not practical in Dungeons and Dragons. It's a game about a party. There are mechanics. The mechanics of the game make it so if you have to fight in a group or you're dead. This is obviously different. This is what we wish Dungeons and Dragons felt like to play. Playing this badass who was slipping around, killing people easily, and a fight didn't take 3 hours of a session. But the core party in the Icewind Dale trilogy are Drizzt, a ranger. Oh, I forgot his name. Wulfgar, a barbarian. Brunor, a fighter. And, oh man, what's the halfling called? There is a halfling. His name starts with an R, I think. And he is a rogue. But he doesn't have any rogue abilities. He's just really good at persuasion. That's literally his whole thing. He's good at persuasion. That's it. That's the whole reason he's in the party. And mostly he just gets kidnapped, at least in that trilogy. And then eventually a girl joins the group, and I don't know what her class is. I think she's just fighter with a bow. The point being is they have no magic users, and they have no healers whatsoever. There is no one in the party who has access to any healing magic. So it's the least realistic D&D party ever, because when Catty Breeze play a character would join that table, they'd be like, no, 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 no. You have to play a cleric. I'm sorry. Please, please. We have no one to heal us.
I mean, I've been in this situation many a time where we've all created characters independently, rocked off and gone, right, so no healers. Okay, this is going to be short.
And also, like, they get sad when their friends die, and I'm like, why? Just bring him back. You know how this works.
One thing that I've always had been quite curious about, I would love to get your opinion on, whenever you're reading literature that's specifically, like, pulling from D&D, or even when, like, people do play D&D, how much do you feel like it's really good when people make a conscious effort to tie class to character? Like, your class isn't just a set of abilities that you do, but it's part of who you are, e.g. to be a rogue, or you know, if you're an assassin, like, that is a job. It's not just your combat skill set.
I'm in both camps, because on one hand, I feel like a game should make it so that being a paladin feels very paladin-y. That's part of why I really dislike that the latest version of the game, the Paladin Oaths, don't have oaths. You don't actually have rules you have to live up to. Like, the Oath of Vengeance said, this is what it means to be a Vengeance Paladin. You have these four tenets. To be an Oath of Devotion Paladin, one of the tenets was, you can't lie. That's actually really interesting. Like, that's how dedicated to good you need to be this character. Those don't exist anymore. Now you can be an Oath of Devotion Paladin who kicks puppies, and, like, there's nothing in a rulebook that says you can't kick puppies as a paladin.
it's one of these ones.
On the other hand.
Oh, yeah, the other hand. I want to hear the other hand. Sorry. I'm in the first camp. I'm a hard, like, that's part of, I almost feel like that's part of balancing. I'm like, yeah, you devotion, you get some cool shit. This is what you can't do to balance it. But yeah, what's the other hand?
The other hand is that there's a certain, it cuts the other way, because if you kneel down and you introduce your character praying to a god, everyone at the table will assume that you're a paladin or a cleric. And there's this weird friction. I keep using the word friction. I got to stop doing that because I'm making it completely meaningless.
Cognitive dissonance.
There's this weird discrepancy. There's this weird discrepancy between... Actually, no, dissonance is better for this. Thank you, Duncan. Yeah, there's a dissonance between my character believes in a god because he lives in a world where gods exist. He doesn't need to be a cleric to be religious. And people believe that if they want their character to be devout, they have to be a cleric, and they don't. And the other friction... fuck. And the other dissonance is that I once introduced a player, a character to the game, dressed up in motley, carrying a mandolin and playing in a bar for money. And everyone was like, okay, Geordi, you're a stranger. We've never met before. You're playing a bard. Okay, let's go on this adventure. And as soon as we arrived at the adventure site, they said, okay, hold up, everyone. My character takes off his outfit, he puts on his chainmail, he puts out his sword. I've actually been a paladin the whole time. Because, why can't my paladin start off as like a musician? And, you know, a paladin is something that he is when he's fighting, but the rest of the time, he has other trades and he has other skills.
Do you know what? That is... Oh, no, now you've cut me hard. Now I don't know where to fall. But I think it's about having rules and then seeing the flex within those rules. As you said, you don't have to be a cleric to, you know, be devout and follow a religion. Just because you're a paladin and you don't lie doesn't mean you can't enjoy playing the lute.
That's right. Going on beyond this, Dritz goes to assassin school. He refuses to let it change him. The big conflict of the book is... Will Drow society crush the goodness which Zach Nathan bestowed into Dritz, either or through both his inheritance or through his learning? And Dritz is never tempted by evil.
Nope.
There's never a question in the book that he will succumb. Again, in the second book, that is the big conflict, but it emerges not even out of his upbringing. It emerges out of his isolation, which is... interesting. That's an interesting statement for the author to make.
But just kind of focusing on this first one, I know we talked about him taking the propaganda before, and that's quite an interesting take. It's not so much that he ever thinks to not be good. The closest he gets in this book is simply being tricked into misinterpreting what the good action is. That's, I'd say, is pretty much it. What I have to say about this school bit, I was very wary that I was going to read special guy goes to special school to learn to be special. Have to say, Dritz is a special guy. Mm. This is, by definition, a bit of a special school. He learns nothing about how to be special here. Like, he comes special, and he just stays special. We jump over lessons, like,
literally the only thing he learns at this school is don't trust drow.
And this is really delicate. Like, in the very first scene, it's like, okay, guys, for your sort of induction day, you're all going to have just a massive brawl, and we'll see who comes out on top. First thing he does, he trusts someone, they betray him, he gets knocked down, and then literally, just to capstone this entire section of the book, they have another brawl, he thinks that he's, you know, they think he's made the same mistake again and being too trusting, but haha, he's one step ahead and takes him out. And like, that's the entire arc in this like academy section of the book.
What we should actually get into is that we've talked about the like internal conflict. The real conflict is the conspiracy between the houses.
Yeah, it's not as interesting. So as the internal conflict, is my opinion.
Okay. I mean, But there isn't any internal conflict.
Yeah,
that's what
not
you just said.
The idea of them actually having internal conflict. The villains in this book, okay. Listen, I'm going to level with you. They ain't Thrawn. They are literally there because we're in book one and there needs to be someone to be stabbed at the end of it. They somewhat play into the theme of like the Drow Society, the evil of Drow Society produce more evil because it's a cycle of violence. There, I do like that. But the actual villain is freaking hilarious. Like, I actually flipped back over the comic and the guy drew him like Skeletor, which did not help at all. But it's this sense of, so this is the guy we spoke about, I don't know, 40 minutes ago, who becomes like the faceless one. He's like, I will kill Dritz. And someone genuinely asked him at one point, like, why him? He wasn't even born on the day. And he's like, ah, but he's the main character, so it must be him. I'm like, dude, like, really, if anyone, it should be his older brother. Or, you know, Matron Malice, the one who's actually set this up. And this just kind of plays out. And there's some more politicking. There's sort of this, like, so this guy's working with another house, whose name I have forgotten already. And they're like, oh, we're going to fight the Dritz's family. And then, oh, there's a conflict brewing in the background. But what I find really interesting is that in this story, this doesn't really spill out. Like, Dritz sort of just nopes out before this conflict fully comes to the fold.
It's true. They're really, again, this turns into a review of the second book, but the really strange part about it is that I was convinced that the end of the second book would be him leaving. Like, the war between the houses would be what the second book was about. And Drizzt's conflict would be that I've kind of checked out emotionally of this place, but I have to do this because I need to defend my family. But the end of this book is he says, nah, fuck it, I'm done, I'm out. And he just goes, he leaves. And in the next book, there is a war between the houses that spans 10 years. But it's over in chapter 2.
And it's a curious one because from a reader's perspective, this gets quite a lot of page time. We get a few scenes when we're looking back at like Matron Malice, and her motivation is like she needs to find out who's plotting against her and why the spider god is unhappy with her, and like she needs to get the spider god's favour. And this does play into Dritz's story quite heavily because it's him sparing the child that means they lose their favour, and it's her trying to regain favour. That's why, as we referenced earlier, Dritz's father Zach dies at the end as like a sacrifice. So it does motivate Dritz's story, but or in such a kind of a sidelining way. It's kind of this sense of, it's something, this war is motivating Dritz's mother to do the things that then motivate Dritz. And there's this other guy who looks like Skeletor in the comic who is sort of there. And it just doesn't quite all come together for me, despite the fact that like a lot of time goes into it. And I feel maybe, and Geordie, tell me if you agree, I liked it from the sense that I do like a bit of world building, and this did kind of flesh out like the sense of Drow society. Oh, this is what's all the politicking's going on between the great houses. This is how they, you know, spend their days just planning to murder each other. But it, because it didn't like actually come to the full fold in the end, I kind of got to the end of this book and went, and his mother could have just murdered the dad because they needed to get the favour back, just because they'd fallen out of favour. You know, there didn't have to be this external motivator. It almost as if it wasn't happening, everything else would have played out the same. The faceless one still could have wanted to murder Dritz or his brother. His mother could have still wanted to have murdered the father. And there didn't need to be a civil war. It didn't actually impact the plot. Am I wrong? Do you disagree? I have ranted for a while.
So I do not necessarily disagree, and this is where I feel like our differences in experience of the Forgotten Realms varies and matters. Duncan, House Bayen Rae.
House Bayen Rae.
Who are they in this book? House Bayen Rae, led by, what's her name, Eonavol?
Sure.
Who are they in this book? What purpose do they serve?
So they're the villainous house that I've been talking about. They're plotting against
No, they're not.
No?
House Bane, that's House Hunnet. House Hunnet goes and they sign up, they enlist with the remnant of House de Vere, Alton de Vere. House Hunnet are the enemies of House de Worden, who are trying to bring them down. House Bane is the chief house of Menzo Berezon. Yonneville is the main matron that oversees the city and is the great puppeteer who looks out over the squabbling. If you follow the very pertinent Dune comparison, she takes on the role of the Emperor, looking over, and is kind of the power behind the villainous House Harkonnen. And speaking as someone who has played, for example, Waterdeep Dragon Heist, when I see House Bane, I go, oh, so this is where House Bane gets brought in. And then they say, okay, yeah, this makes sense. Now a lot of stuff about that game is making sense to me. And then they say, and this is our first son of a house. And I go, I lean forward and they say, it's some guy. And I go, what do you mean some guy? It can't just be some guy. Where's Jalaxle? Where the fuck is Jalaxle? He's the main guy. And then I spend this whole book thinking, like, why is Jaxle going to show up? And then I start to read book two. And guess what? Jalaxle shows up in book two at the start of chapter two. But they're like, Jalaxle, a houseless drow. And I'm like, Jalaxle, a houseless drow? Wait, what's going to happen next? Because if he's houseless now, how does he get associated with? Huh?
I see. I see what I've missed. And I'm really glad you, like, illustrated it that way. Because I'm like, oh, okay, I see how this plays up and how this could interlink and, like, what would drive your intrigue. And maybe, because this is weird for me, I normally love the world building. I'm normally all about it. And
missing out on context because you're reading this first and I'm benefiting from reading this last.
Well, it's that thing where, because obviously at the end of this book, Drizzt walks away, it leaves me as a first-time reader going, oh, I'm assuming as he's walking away from this society, he's walking away from these plot threads. I know it does come into it a bit more in the second, but by the time we get to the end of the third and presumably going to Icewind Dale, it really feels like all of this politicking is being left behind and no longer of consequence to my main character. So why do I care? And that's so what me, sort of hung over it.
Yeah, to me, where we leave off the house, partially in the end of this book, book one, like, oh, it's a hanging thread, it's going to be completed later. And in mild spoilers, in book two, some of these threads are resolved, but not all of them. To me, that's the sword of Damocles. That's the long-term payoff. That, to me, is Salvatore saying, okay, you'll have read this book, and then you're going to think that, okay, well, I've already read what happens next in Icewind Dale, so surely the whole story's over. That gives him something else to write in the third series. Whatever comes after Icewind Dale, Trilogy of the Silver Mountain or something.
Can I ask, Jordy, and this just popped in my head because you're talking about, you know, the sequence of the books. Is there, like, an official chronology for, like, when player adventures are meant to take place in Forgotten Realms?
Yes, Duncan, I'm so glad you asked me that. Yes, there are, and it is confusing. So, I'm going to start off with the light version by just talking about 5th edition.
Thank you, much appreciated.
So, in 5th edition, all of the adventures start off in chronological order. For one thing, the first couple are legitimately supposed to take place. You're supposed to play one, and then play the next, and then play the next. Some of those, you'd even carry characters in between. At a certain point, the leveled players are a little bit too powerful. So, what we need to do is, we're going to start off write new adventures, and we're going to jump forward just a couple of years, like 3 years in the future. So all in all, the adventures in the Forgotten Realms kind of take place in a weird order. But at a certain point, you get to Waterdeep Dragon Heist. Waterdeep Dragon House then leads into Dungeon of the Mad Mage. But Icewind Dale comes out next, and that gets moved, and for some reason, this takes place before Waterdeep Dragon Heist, like a couple of years before it. And I believe, I said it with a lot of confidence, but I may be wrong, I may be thinking of Baldur's Gate Descent into Avernus, that might take place beforehand.
Nope, vindicated again, I should always believe in myself.
But the thing is that all of these events, all of these stories, tie into previous adventures. Like, for example, you know who one of the main villains in Waterdeep Dragon Heist is? It's Jalaxle. I have met in a game, Jalaxle, and I got in his face, and I insulted him, and it was only upon reading this book series that I was like, oh shit, that was a bad idea. That guy really probably should have killed me. My Dungeon Master was being really nice when he let me talk shit to him.
That does sound... See, now I feel like I've just missed out. Do you know what? I know what this is down to, Geordie. I've just not had a DM who can actually run proper Forgotten Realms games. That's what I've been missing in my life. They always just want to write their own stuff.
I'm not going to let Tom listen to this episode now. Jesus Christ, what a horrible thing to say. All the things that our good friend Tom has done for you, and you're just going to slag him off. But right, it's part of the skill of running in the Forgotten Realms, which is not necessarily the best setting for games like this, is having someone who actually cares enough to look back in and try and make the whole setting work. Because if you make that effort to tie it all in together, the games benefit a lot. I've run Icewind Dale games where I paid attention to what actually happened in the Icewind Dale trilogy to make the setting feel more alive. I ran Waterdeep Dragon Heist for some players. I didn't want to run Dungeon of the Mad Mage next, which you're supposed to do. So instead, I cropped out the first part of Descent into Avernus and made that the sequel. And I made very special attention to make sure the timeline of those games was altered to make sure that that made sense. If you are going to run Tomb of Annihilation, for example, I think that it behooves you as a Dungeon Master to sow the seeds of the Death Curse early. Let it be known that weird stuff is going on. Maybe you want to go to Chult next. And if you don't, there's going to be consequences because the Death Curse is going to leak out to the rest of the world.
It's just sort of the joy of Dungeon Mastering. And the more you sort of take in and learn and know, it does kind of work as like an osmosis. I can't speak to like Georgie's experience of running official like Forgotten Realms games at all. But just on a very small, like, microcosm of that, I did do a Conan game once. It's the only game I ever run. That's why it's the only one I ever bring up. But just by the fact of, like, being someone who then knows the literary canon so well, it meant that whenever the players maybe, like, slightly stepped off the game map, it was really nice then that I could just kind of just drop in, oh, yeah, no, don't worry. I know what that city is, like, canonically, and what's happening there. So you can then sort of...
It was good. It really did give the feeling of a fulfilled and present world where stuff was happening. Much more so than I could do with Conan.
Thank you. I will take this compliment, and to be honest, it will make my week. So I really do appreciate that. But, as you say...
As I say, there is a point where it goes too far. Because Duncan... You asked me, how do Dungeons & Dragons Adventures tie in chronologically? And I answered with the simple version. But there are other ways, Duncan. Let me tell you a little bit about the Spell Plague.
Is this a multiverse? I'm getting multiverse vibes.
No. If only, Duncan. God, if only it was a multiverse. So... This book is set in Dungeons & Dragons, the world of Dungeons & Dragons, and it specifically takes place in 2nd edition. The characters in this book can do the things which characters in 2nd edition can do. Well, guess what, Duncan? At a certain point, they moved to 3rd edition.
Oops.
And then after that, they moved to 4th edition. and then they moved to 5th edition. And in each of those games, the rules of the game change and characters can no longer do stuff they used to be able to do. And to just hone in, I'm not going to talk about this from a position of authority because I wasn't there. I got my start playing 2nd edition Dungeons & Dragons for some reason, even though that was not the game that was in mode at the time when I started playing at 11 years old. I never played any 3rd edition. I played one game of 4th edition, but at the time that 4th edition came out, the game changed radically. The spells behaved in really different ways. And so all these books are coming out, and suddenly the characters should be able to do stuff they normally aren't be able to do. So what's the in-canon reason? And the in-canon reason is that some fucking balmy shit is going on in heaven where the god of magic, Mistra, like, dies, and then magic fundamentally changes in what's called the spell plague, which is extremely confusing and very disruptive. And it's basically like when you're reading a Marvel comic and an event happens and everything else has to go on pause to deal with this weird stuff that happens, and then you just have to carry on with your adventures, but all the rules are different and you just have to sort of live with it. And then 4th edition was really unsuccessful, so they move to 5th edition, and they just say, oh, Mistra came back. And there's a light switch that gets flipped, and the rules of magic work differently again, and they're close to how they used to be.
I mean, praise to the authors that keep up with this and try and, like, create a consistent world. The simple fact that they still want to keep these books canon, despite the fact that the game has fundamentally changed, and, you know, we're generations of players down the line, I think is impressive. So I'm not, like, annoyed that it's convoluted and doesn't quite work, because, brutally honest, I don't think there's a world or a pitch you could ever do where I would say, yeah, that could work. That's why I threw out, is this a multiverse? Could that be my way? I'd be like, right, moving to 5th edition, what does that mean? We're shifting to another multiverse? Please hold on, things might be slightly different. Please ignore them.
Unfortunately, they already shot that load, because it is multiverse, because you have Dragonlance, which is legitimately a different planet, and then you have Greyhawk. The actually kind of savvy thing they did with this 2024 edition Dungeons & Dragons, or 5.5 if you prefer, is they just sort of half did it, because we're no longer running on Forgotten Realms. Now the official setting is Greyhawk, the original Dungeons & Dragons setting.
I'll be honest, Jordy, I don't think I know a lick about it. For me, when I think D&D, and this is probably related to the fact that so many PC games came out in the late 90s, which I sort of played when I was younger, to me, it is Forgotten Realms. Like, that's where Baldur's Gate is, that's where Neverwinter is, that's where Icewind Dale is.
It is, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And all of those settings are, like, the setting of, like, Dungeons & Dragons books. A lot of stuff happens in Waterdeep Dragon Heist, and I hadn't read the Neverwinter books, so I had to do a lot of Wikipedia-ing to figure out why are the Neverembers so important. Duncan?
Yes?
I'm really glad we had this discussion about the wider canon of Dungeons & Dragons books, because to be frank, I haven't read that many of them, but I do have a serious soft spot for Salvatore's work. It's not high art, but I do really understand the appeal that you find in Star Wars novelizations. And I'm feeling that same itch being scratched here. And I like it. I really like reading this book. I like reading the second book. And I'm enjoying the third book even more right now.
I'm so happy to hear that. And I really want to emphasize, because I'm very worried that people might be taking that out of a negative approach of this book. That isn't the case. Like, there's a lot when you put the magnifying up to it that, like, you can rip apart and batter about. And partly doing this, like, as a podcast, that's what I feel somewhat inclined to do, because, you know, we've got a slot to fill, and if I just said, yeah, I liked it, some weird bits, but overall, some cool action, happy days, it wouldn't take an hour. But I still had fun, and to be honest with you, Jordy, I kind of feel like I'm almost forlorn. Like, it's like I've peeped into this world, and I'm like, oh my god, there's so much more vastness here to be explored. I kind of wish I had a bit more in me to get into it, because it certainly feels like something there. The more you invest, the more you're going to get back out. And like you what you emphasize so well is that, like, if you're a player of these games and you play D&D in the world of Forgotten Realms, oh my god, 100%, please, you re-engage with the literature. It's fun. It's not too demanding of a reader. And it is, it's robust. You know, it is well written. And yes, there are some silly moments, but there's also some cool action moments. I don't put enough emphasis on that. The action is, again, it's not 10 out of 10 in this book.
I'd put it one step below Matthew Stover.
Yes. Oh, I put Matthew Stover quite on a high pedestal, but maybe you... No, you're right. It is one step below. Almost, if anything, R.A. Salvatore, lean into it more. I give you writing advice from a book from, like, the 90s. Lean into it more. Be more, like, operatic, maybe. Make sure it's, like, more... Give me more Elric in Drizzt. I've gone back into the other pronunciation.
Oh, we didn't even talk about Elric! What the hell? I thought that was going to be all we talked about, but I literally forgot. Let's go over it super brief.
Okay, Drizzt is Elric with scimitars. But he's not Elric enough, personally. I think he could be more. He needs to be moping and forlorn and, oh, for art thou I be the most miserable soul on earth. There's a bit of that here. I think he's still got his cool head on. He's still, like, young Drizzt. I want to see old Drizzt, and I hope by, like, book 29 we get to that point where he's just, like, seen so much crap that he's just getting, like, tired and bored of it.
I want to see that too. He's a tiny bit mopier at times, but I will say that the definitive thing, which is not in this book, but is very much present in Icewind Dale, the definitive thing you can say about Drizzt and what his philosophy is, he's a stoic. And as a stoic, his fundamental thing is, like, the world is really hard and you need to not let that affect you. So the reason he's not as mopey as he ought to be, and I think a really big reason why people liked him so much when he was coming out and people wanted to play him, is that the whole point of the character Drizzt is the people on the surface, and obviously, Duncan, you've only had a limited amount of experience with that, don't like him. They don't trust him right from sight. They're racist towards him. They make presumptions about him based on his appearance. And the whole point of Drizzt's character is that people treat me cruelly, and I'm gonna tough my way through it. I'm gonna be a good person despite the fact the world is unfair. And it appeals to that sense of the world is unfair. Ugh, I'm not leading the life I wish I was. People, the grown-ups, they just don't get it, man. But I'm gonna be like Drizzt. I'm gonna be tough. I'm gonna be cool. I'm not gonna let it affect me. And they'll see what a hero I am in the end. That's a big part of the appeal. And that's what separates him from someone like Elric, who is a total moody guts. He who sees that the world is evil and unfair and is broken by it. This is the heroic equivalent. This is the never back down. This is the stay true to it and occasionally let your evil alter ego take over so you can do bad things and kind of feel bad about it, but know that it wasn't really your fault.
Yeah, more on that if we do end up covering the sequel. And that's the mood. I think I'm a little bit more... I think for Drizzt to work for me, I think if he just had a bit more of a... Oh, God, I can't believe I was about to say this. I didn't actually plan this, end of the sentence. If he just had a bit more of, like, a party to maybe bounce off of, people he could sort of show a little bit more charisma with, that would work
well,
really nicely.
Duncan... Do I have a book series for you? It's called the second and third book in the Icewind Dale trilogy. That kind of happens in the first one, but really it's the second and third.
To be honest, that's actually the...
Drizzt and Wolfgar are legitimately a really good duo.
I'm sure they are, and I think that's almost the only... Not the only... Another little downside to Homeland. Because everyone around him is either evil or the father figure.
His dad.
Yeah. It's like, there's not a lot for him. There aren't actually that many other characters other than his dad, who I really feel like he has any kind of conversation with. He doesn't really have a friend in this entire book to just chat about.
I mean, we haven't spoken about his cat friend. Duncan, what's that character called?
What? Oh, his cat. Oh, God.
Yeah, his panther.
His panther. It's called...
I could not believe how ridiculously it is spelt when I saw it written down.
I actually can't remember. What's the name of Driss's panther? No. I'll get this. I can do this. I want to channel like some Arthurian stuff into this, like, because it's like I want to be like Guinevere, but it's not. It's like, or is it?
Say it with some confidence.
Guinevere. Do you know what? Fuck it. It's Guinevere.
It's, you're very close. But for dear listeners, the name is spelled GUENHWYVAR. Guinevere. That is the Forgotten Realms, folks. Normal names spelt wrong or just a little wrong.
So, Geordie, I think we've definitely round up a lot of this. It's a cool character, by the way. I like the fact that he joins Driss because Driss is like, yo, don't follow your evil master. We're mates. Love that scene. In fact, it was probably one of the most emotionally like effective scenes.
I agree. That was a good scene.
So can't wait to see more of them play off each other in the future. Who do you recommend this book for?
Anyone who plays Dungeons and Dragons and really likes it. Anyone who is a dungeon master running games in the Forgotten Realms. I recommend it to people who like, who want a really simple, straightforward adventure. But I don't actually recommend this book. I recommend The Crystal Shard, the first book in the Icewind Dale trilogy, because now that I've read both, I still believe that that is the right way to start this series. Sorry.
I want to agree with you full-heartedly, and I think it's really good to recognise there are people in society who really do latch onto this idea of reading things in chronological order, as if that is somehow makes any more sense, and that stories aren't complex things that don't need chronology sometimes to work, or work better without them. Yes, this book is in no way bad. Well, in some ways. This book was enjoyable romp for me. I enjoyed it in all the same ways that I'm a man that loves Star Wars tie-in media, that loves his Conan pastiche works. Like, I read stuff of this caliber, in fact worse than this, all the time, and I love it. But as I think we've knocked on again and again and again throughout this episode, this story you will get far more out of the more maybe you've already put in. And I still feel this probably is like an early days, you know, adventure into Forgotten Realms, but probably best not to be me. Don't let this be your absolute ground zero. Like, play D&D if you can.
Yeah, definitely a better experience than this.
Go in and read maybe one of the other books. I have a lot of faith in Geordie, and I will tell you now, I will probably read The Crystal Shard at some point. But when?
Well, when indeed, Duncan. Could it perhaps be in 2 weeks' time with our next episode? Please, Duncan, tell me, what is our next big read?
Well, Geordie, I had a really enjoyable time with this book, and I definitely feel like I do want to take this journey forward, and that's something I can't deny, but I don't know if it's going to be my next one. There's just something else that's been on my kind of to-read list for a while that I just really want to cross off with you, and it just begrudges me that maybe I committed to this idea quite early on. But I can't shake it, and I want to do this book. And I think it would be taking us in an interesting direction. We're going to read something that maybe came out, a little bit before this. Or maybe we're going back a decade.
This book's 1989.
If I've got that right. In that case, we're going back two decades.
Whoa.
This is another high fantasy book written in 1968 by fantasy author Anne McCaffrey. We're going to read the very first Dragon Riders of Pern book, Dragonflight.
Okay, I feel like we are in a similar oeuvre to a Dungeons and Dragons book, because this is obviously an early book. Wow, 1960s, I did not realise that. This is obviously very influential and would influence Dungeons and Dragons when it came out. This is what's going to set off a lot of the Dragon Rider as a thing in fantasy, and I've always wanted to read these books, and I'm very interested to see how they have aged and how they've developed. 1960s. There we go.
Right, well, that's been it for this episode, everyone. It is a pleasure to bring this to you all. If you have anything to add to our conversation this week on the Driz books, on the works of Aristotle, on Forgotten Realms, on D&D, on fantasy in general, the best place, as always, to reach out to us is on our Instagram. It's Just Fantasy Podcast. A post will be going out when this episode is released. Just drop a message there. Like the post, say what you think about it. If you like the episode and you think we've completely got it wrong, if you think you should still start with Homeland over the Crystal Shard, that's the place to voice it to us.
Or maybe somewhere else. Perhaps we should start with the Return of the Demon Heir 2 and the Crystal Crancenabon, or maybe the Battle of a Thousand Orcs, or perhaps even the birth of Drit's daughter. I'm just throwing out factoids I vaguely know from future books. Some of those may be wrong.
Well, if that's the case, drop it in the comments. Geordie will understand. Another great place to reach us, as always, is at our Gmail account. It's just fantasypodcast at gmail.com. Great place to give more kind of details, messages to us. If you've got an opinion, if you've got a question, perhaps, you know, I always answer them. I love to give back my own knowledge. And who knows, it might even make it into an own episode one day. Great place. There's also our Blue Sky, which is Just Fantasy. I always have to struggle to remember that one because you can't name your Blue Sky a long name like the others. So yes, Just Fantasy on Blue Sky. Again, you'll see extra content there and on Instagram. Occasional extra reviews of other things me and Geordie have been reading and enjoying.
Thank you, Dunk. I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
I've been your host, Duncan Nicol.
So long.
Bye.